Welcome to the Lovejoy Hour, sponsored by Cook 100 degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. Tea on tap. Can you imagine that? Well, you don't have to, as Cooker have made it available. Go to cooker.co.uk for more details. This week, Hour, I'm curious about whether our food is killing us. Joining me is Joy Manning, who's written a book, which is called Is Our Food Killing Us? On the cover, it states, never before have we produced so much food for so many people around the world, but at what cost to our health and the health of the planet? This podcast scares me a bit because I know how obsessive people are, militant about food. That's probably the word. People get really aggravated if you mention the fact that their food might not be good, or so it does worry me doing this. Hopefully you'll enjoy it, and hopefully I can be balanced. Anyway, let's meet her. Here's Joy. Hi, Joy. How are you?
I'm great, Tim. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you. Well, I suppose the first thing we should do, I love the book, by the way, I thoroughly enjoyed it. When I say enjoyed reading it, I'm not sure enjoyment is the word, because there's some very serious points being made in it.
Right.
But tell us a bit about yourself, first of all. I think that's the best thing.
Well, I just want to say that even though it's not the most feel-good read you're likely to pick up, I do hope that it motivates people to sort of take charge of their own health, you know, and in their own, become a food activist in their own community. So with that said, my interest in food and nutrition goes back, I don't know, to birth. When I went on my first date with my husband almost 20 years ago, I was lecturing him about partially hydrogenated oils and the dangers of trans fats. So it's always been important to me. I'm a former nutrition editor at Prevention Magazine, and I'm a health writer and journalist. So I don't know. It's just really a part of my DNA.
So what made you decide to write this book then?
Well, Thames and Hudson came to me with the opportunity, and I thought it would be a really great chance to put all of the key ideas about the global food system into one place, sort of, and in a very easy to read context. Like, as we mentioned, the content is heavy, but the way the book is designed makes it approachable, easy to read. You know, you could even skim it. It would be easy to read it in a lot of short sessions. So I felt like it made this heavy information very digestible.
You've certainly done that. I love the format of the book. And I suppose you need to do that because it's great, the amount of stats and facts and things you've put in it. And I suppose if you just written it in a traditional way, it would have just been very dense and heavy stats. But because it's very, I use this word in a nice way, bitty. And I think that's the style of it. It means you can consume it quite easily. There's a lot of research in there, isn't there? Where have you got most of your research from?
As a health journalist, I read all of this relevant health studies pretty much every day. I get the digests from all the major journals. I also try to stay on top of the books. There's a really, if people do find themselves interested in the topic, there's a robust bibliography of books that we referred to or that I drew information from in the back of the book. And I think that it's a great place to start for more reading. And I'm a nerd. I love to read. So I would say reading is how I get most of my information.
Okay.
I've definitely interviewed a lot of doctors and scientists as well. So,
right. So I suppose we should just start really by hitting on what is wrong with our food. There's myriad things, but I think it's a huge subject, as you know. But what are the main things that we need to realize about the food we're consuming?
Well, I think one of the most important things to be aware of is that the standard American diet, the Western diet, is bad for your health, very bad. It contributes to heart disease, which is a leading killer, cancer, diabetes. I could go on and on. And now it's been exported around the world. So I think that it's hard to notice that your diet is so profoundly unhealthy when it's so normal. So I think one thing people should become aware of is how this diet even came to, you know, basically dominate much of the globe. And it's because of money. You know, capitalism drives what we eat. In the United States, you know, we have the same agency, the USDA, advocating for the business of factory farmers and also supposedly advocating for the health of Americans by setting our dietary guidelines. And those two things are in conflict. So that becoming aware of those things, I think, helps you make better choices instead of just going along with the predominant culture around food, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I was going to say to you, and I was going to wait till later on in the interview so we didn't fall out, but I was going to say to you, is this all Americans' fault?
Maybe. I mean,
you've come in right at the beginning and said the American diet, but you know,
I am American, and America has certainly contributed many positive things to the world, but this way of eating is not among them. This is terrible, you know.
So what are the things,
as bad in the UK and many other places where it's become, you know, standard.
Oh, we absolutely love the American diet. We've you know, I believe that Kellogg's was American. He invented the cornflake, and then the French fry is American, and the burger is American, right. And the chicken burger is American. And I mean, it might have started in other places, but it's America who made that whole thing, the fast food chain.
And where it proliferates, we have an obesogenic environment, which we discuss in the book. And that's an environment that makes it the path to becoming sick and overweight and obese sort of the default. And I have a lot of compassion toward people who are struggling with these diet-induced health problems, because it's a little bit difficult. You have to go against the grain to avoid them, pretty much.
Yeah. How long has it been this way, Joy?
Oh my goodness, for a very long time. I think the advent of processed and manufactured foods goes back to the 40s and 50s, and it has just become worse from there. The 1980s saw an explosion in the production of high fructose corn syrup, which really, you know, quadrupled, or, you know, probably 100x times the amount of junk food that we had all around us all the time. You know, I wrote about how chickens have been bred to become bigger and fatter. And that has been happening for, you know, since the 40s. But when it comes to my parents ate a little better or had a more, you know, wholesome food system than I have. And their parents had a more wholesome food system than they had. It just becomes progressively more processed, more manufactured, less, you know, a whole foods based diet, which was really optimal for human health.
So I wonder how many generations we think, because my granddad used to say to me that they would only really be able to eat meat once a week, and
right.
And his mother sent all the, because, you know, it was back in the good old days of England and London, they had like 9 brothers and sisters, all of them, and families back in those days. And she used to send them all to work at the hotels because there's catering there and they could get food. So it's only sort of my parents' generation after the war where we've had such an abundance of food, I believe, mm-hmm. that we can make ourselves obese, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you have to make yourself not obese. If you follow, you know, if you go with the flow in cultures like the UK and in the United States, then you are going to have a diet that makes you sick. So, I mean, I personally follow a plant-based vegan diet for both my health and environmental reasons. It's hard. Once you know this stuff, it really affects your choices. Or I found that to be true for myself.
Are you finding it hard to find food to eat once you've made those choices? I mean, obviously, when you're just at home and you know your local shops, it's easy. But when you go venture out or go on holiday or anything, is it hard?
The very thing. It's interesting because of this global pandemic that we've been living in. It's been very easy because I, you know, choose all my own food for myself and my husband. Everything we eat has been cooked at home. But I find that when I'm socializing with other people, going to restaurants, that's when it becomes something of a challenge. I try to take it as an opportunity to be a good example, share information if people are interested. And I also try to drive the choices of where eating events take place so I can choose places that are with the program, so to speak, and offer options that are, you know, environmentally and physically healthier.
And how do people take to that? Because it seems to me the world's getting very militant with their food. Often you go onto social media and someone will say vegan or plant-based or carnivore. You have a lot of people.
Astonishing to me. the whole carnivore train is or trend is just a completely astonishing thing to me. I don't understand how that came to be, or you know what these that makes no sense. But anyway, sorry.
Some people
eat meat on purpose.
Yeah, for people who don't know what the carnivore diet is, it's literally only meat. That's all they eat, and it's red meat generally. And they just consume it from the minute they wake up to the minute they go to bed. They believe that they eat less because of it. They believe that they're healthier. And I think Jordan Peterson, doesn't he have the carnivore diet? And he believes it's helped him eradicate some disease or something to his immune system or something. So there's a lot of people out there who are saying they're eating the carnivore diet, aren't they?
One of the things that's frustrating is when people follow diets like that, it's often for weight loss, and sometimes they do lose weight because they are eliminating so many food groups. But the long-term impact on both their health, and we all know that factory farming, particularly of cattle, is just environmentally disastrous. It's not sustainable, either personally or globally.
Yeah. People do get very fractious about it, don't they, though, about talking about food. How do you find it? You know, you're putting this book out there. I think a lot of people don't want to know, do they?
True.
And I get a lot of people say to me things like everything in moderation. And then you say, well, yeah, but are you really eating that fast food in moderation? I'm not sure. So do you get a lot of pushback on your studies and your...
say that people are generally, you know, accepting of me personally and whatever my choices are. But I have definitely found that a lot of people don't want to hear about it. They don't want to know. They'd rather just, you know, move forward with their highly processed, like, lunch meat and cheese. I live in Philadelphia, so this cheesesteak is big here. And they just rather not know. And that's sad to me, but I just keep doing my part writing. I wrote this book, obviously, but a lot of my work, I write for websites and magazines and newspapers, centers around this topic. So I'm always trying to gently educate people in a non-judgmental way.
Yeah. I work on a cooking show. So basically it's all great ingredients we have, but I see all sorts of food come and go on my show. So mm-hmm. I have a very, very interesting view of
what's your show? I love cooking shows.
Oh, it's called Sunday Brunch. It's a 3-hour show on a Sunday morning, and I present it with a chef, and then we get other chefs in. And what we've noticed recently, though, over the last, I've been doing it, I don't know, 10, 12 years or something. And over the last few years, the amount of plant-based or vegan type chefs are becoming more prevalent. More of the chefs are coming in and will cook meals without meat, even though mm-hmm. meat's still a choice for a lot of them. One of the things I did notice, though, is that you have to be very careful. We have guests on, celebrities as well, and there's a real battle as well. I don't know what it is with food at the moment, but there's a real battle between vegans and plant-based. And sometimes you'll have a guest say, I'm a vegan, and or a plant-based. I really don't. I mean, I can't get into the finer details of it. But people get really angry on social media. You know, you're doing it wrong. You're saying it wrong. This is this. This is that. And, you know, I do find this battle we have over what we're eating is part of the problem. And I think maybe, Joy, it's because we're being told a lot of it's bad for us a lot of the time.
I think for most people, it is counterproductive to pay attention to that. It's mostly just useless internet noise. The things that will prevent your food from killing you and also contribute to the health of the planet are the common sense things we have always known. You know, eat plenty of fruits and vegetables, try to get them locally. You know, carbon sequestration is something that comes from cover crops and plants like beans and lentils. So, you know, eat, if you're going to eat meat, try to do it in moderation. Meatless Monday is a great program to get started. You know, it doesn't have to be 100%. It doesn't have to be argumentative. The more you can move towards a diet and even individual meals that are in line with your values as it pertains to health and the environment, the better off you'll be. It doesn't have to be complicated. And it's certainly not all or nothing.
You mentioned it a few minutes ago, and one of the striking bits in your book is the evolution of the chicken.
Yes.
I mean, I'm laughing, but it is horrific. The chicken you have here from, let me just check the date on this. The chicken from 1957 weighs 905 grams. And as you say in the book, it's the one that your grandparents would say, chickens taste different. They were tastier years ago. The chicken in 2005, only 2005 was... So that's 905 grams in 57, and this is a 56 days old. In 2005, it's 4,202 grams. I mean, nearly five times a bigger chicken. I mean, the picture is absolutely insane. How did we get there?
It's such a good example because it shows putting profits over people, animals, and the environment. Back generations ago, there was the idea that you might have a roast chicken on Sunday or maybe even once a month. And now we live in a world where chicken is, you know, consumed sometimes at multiple meals a day, or you go to a restaurant and you have an absurdly large bucket of chicken wings. And so to meet that demand, it needed to become faster to produce, cheaper to make. The chickens needed to have more usable yields. So that's how we got ourselves into this situation. And that way of thinking is true across the board when it comes to the global food system.
Yeah, it says in your book, the U.S. Department of Agriculture held a contest to breed a bigger, better chicken. It was called the Chicken of Tomorrow contest. And it's just carried on going from there, has it? They've now
better. I think better is the word. What is better? Is it better? I understand the original intention was to help farmers and help make more chicken available to more people at a better price. But what we have gotten is not a better chicken.
How do they get them to be that big? Is it hormones?
Breeding, hormones, feed. I would say those are the major ways.
Hmm. What do you think of the artificial protein market? I did a podcast on it not so long ago because it seems to be growing and there's various different aspects of it. There's the type of protein which is sort of brewed, like the
cell cultured meat.
Yeah. And there's the one that you can make in a test tube that's, you know, actually based on meat. And then there's the protein that you're growing and brewing, basically fermenting, I think it is, which is the beyond meat type thing.
Oh, okay.
So there's quite a few of these coming along now. Are they going to be good for us in the environment? I mean, not us personally, but the environment and things like that.
I think a lot remains to be seen when it comes to these alternative meats and how they affect the environment. There's a lot more that goes into it than just the land resources and the water resources. There's also the packaging, transportation, you know, what kind of toll does the production of the product take on the environment? So, and it's still very new. I think it remains to be seen, but I would guess that if we could replace all of the beef and fast food burgers with something like a Beyond Meat or an Impossible Burger, that would probably have a positive effect on the environment.
I wonder if people will take to it though. I mean, I really don't mind eating it. I like things like tofu and I like all the Beyond Meats and stuff.
It's not really going to have a positive impact on people's health. A lot of those burgers are very high in saturated fat, very high in salt, really negligibly better than a beef burger. And in some ways you might think of it as being worse because it is so highly processed from a health perspective.
You mentioned earlier about obesity. Again, if I turn back to your book, if I can find the bit on it, where you say the World Health Organization says 650 million adults are obese. That is a huge amount of humans who are obese. And that's the adults, not even the children. And you say the rate is twice as high it was 50 years ago. Mm-hmm. One of the biggest problems on this, and I'm scared to bring this subject up, is people are pushing back on the word obesity and saying it's healthy, aren't they? Where do you sit on that?
Well, I think you're referring to the fat positive, fat acceptance movement. Yeah. And I think there's a lot of that is good. You know, people who are overweight and obese deserve freedom from discrimination. They deserve their doctor to treat them the same way they would treat a thin person. In some ways, it's one of the last acceptable biases that people have, right? But I don't think that individual people can be blamed for obesity. It is an illness. It is a condition that, of course, their behavior played a role in, but many things beyond their behavior, their genes, their gut microbiome, the environment that they live in, you know, whatever stresses their economic status, all of these things play a role. So I think that we need to support, validate the humanity of, and advocate for the rights of people who are overweight and obese. They're human beings with a health issue. At the same time, I think the idea that there's something, say, fat negative, anti-feminist about wanting to lose weight, I think that that's a dangerous idea. I think people who want to work towards achieving a healthy weight have every right to do so with pride, with support from their people, their friends and family. There's nothing wrong. And in fact, I think there's a lot right with wanting to take control of your health. And I do think the focus should be on health. That's how people end up on the carnivore diet, because we prize thinness and weight loss over all other health metrics, when really we should be looking at blood pressure, blood sugar, cholesterol numbers. It's those, what are the behaviors that drive those metrics down? And in the process, people will very likely lose weight. And I think that's a positive thing. It's a really complex topic. I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, no, it is. I've done a couple of podcasts on, well, I've done a load of podcasts on diet, actually, and I've put myself on a diet trial as well. And there's a lot to be said for gut biomes. Is that the word? Gut, or the microbes.
I actually
anyway.
Just read a fabulous microbiomes. Book. Called fiber fueled, and they refer to it as the gut microbiota.
Okay, fine. Yeah.
People often say gut microbiome as well, though.
Gut microbiome. And they're saying that if you get the wrong type in there, then it's very hard to reverse it. It's very hard to take good gut microbiome and make it bad, but it's hard to reverse it. I also that, and that's if anyone wants to listen to that podcast, it's Professor Tim Spector who does that. And then, but I also talked to Dr. Giles Yeo, who also wrote a book saying, we don't know what it feels like when you're hungry. I have no idea what your hunger feels like to what my hunger feels like. And our bodies have a massive desire to get calories on board for survival. And the point that you make in your book, which is, I think, fascinating and adds to this, is this food is heavily addictive stuff, isn't it? It's very Moorish. It's hard to switch it off.
It's certainly designed to make you want to crave it and eat more, as anyone who has ever eaten a potato chip knows, or a packaged cookie or biscuit, I guess you all say. These things are designed specifically to reach what they call the bliss point, which is all about just making you reach back into the package. And I find that limiting those foods in my life helps me be more in touch with when I'm hungry and when I'm full, because there is research that shows that eating ultra processed and heavily processed foods makes it more difficult for you to tap into your feelings of hunger and fullness. So I personally don't want any part of that, foods that are going to make it hard for my body to self-regulate.
So why aren't governments doing more about this? Why isn't the American government, or, you know, I don't suppose you know what the British government are doing, but why aren't the American government, why aren't they saying, look, enough is enough. We can see that our society is getting unhealthy, I was going to say demand on your health system, but you don't have one, do you? Your demand on the over here is, you know, why aren't the governments trying to change it so that we eat? Is it all purely economics?
I'm glad that you brought that up, because what we've discussed so far, I feel like, puts a lot of the focus on personal responsibility, and your choices do play a role. But of course, our governments also play a role in the United States and around the world. And it is all about, as far as I can tell, it is all driven by money. We subsidize the factory farmers who grow the crops like corn and soy that become the packaged food that is contributing to the obesity epidemic. Meanwhile, farmers that want to grow fruits and vegetables are left without these make or break subsidies that can be, you know, the difference between being able to farm as a career or not. And then that obviously shapes the food supply. If you look at dairy is a very powerful industry. we don't need to eat dairy to have a healthy diet. And in fact, many would say that it contributes to an unhealthy diet. It certainly is the richest source of saturated fat in the American diet, at least. But because dairy farmers are so powerful, we're constantly being sold dairy. You know, products, packaged food products, fast food products, just look for ways to layer in the dairy so that we can move more milk. It's, I don't know why governments don't take, government is certainly not my area of expertise, but I do try to vote for people in my community that have made statements on, you know, things like the farm bill, agricultural subsidies, climate change. These are people that we would like to see more of in government, I think, if we want to try to take steps to have a healthier diet for everyone. I know in the UK, they have banned junk food advertising to children, which is great and something that we should do. That's another arm of legislation that is could be a lot better to promote health.
Yeah, talking about dairy, that's a really interesting one. I'm not sure what I think about dairy. It's fascinating because 10,000 years ago, we were dairy intolerant, and human beings are incredible, really, in our resources. We decided to start drinking and eating dairy products. And 10,000 years later, some of us are still dairy intolerant, but a lot of us are able to get a hell of a lot of calories from dairy. And it just shows you how resourceful we are. And in my lifetime, the population of the world has doubled. And we did this, I discussed this on this podcast, and I can't remember who with, but if we think, oh yeah, it was when I was talking about artificial alternative protein, sorry. Let's call it the developing world. I think that's not a PC way of saying that at the moment, but people are craving more protein because they believe it's the way to go. So whilst people like you are sending the message, we need to stop doing this in places where they're developing, they're going, we want more meat because that is what's healthy. And that's what we want. That's the message they're putting out there.
That's certainly a dominant idea.
So what can we do about that? I mean, you know, it's.
I think the first step is to educate yourself. You can start with a book like mine and then go on to the bibliography and start picking out books there that appeal to your interest. You can get active in your own community, figure out, you know, how policy decisions are made and who you agree with and vote for representation that will serve your interests. And you, I mean, you can try to spread the word. I think that not everyone wants to talk about this, but some people do. There are plenty of food activists worldwide that want to see the global food system change for the better, to support the health of people everywhere and to support the health of the planet.
Joe, I'm just being devil's advocate here a
sure.
bit. I mean, as I say, the population of the world has doubled in my lifetime. How are we going to feed everyone? Is there enough food on the planet to feed everyone in a sustainable, healthy, organic way?
Well, if you think about the amount of food that is used feeding animals and livestock, it takes a great many calories to produce a cow. If we weren't doing that, would we have enough food to feed everyone on the planet? I think so. If human beings were eating those calories instead of livestock,
It'd be tough to tell some Americans they can't have a steak or a burger.
Oh, I know it. I'm only saying that if we shifted our priorities to really reflect the idea that everyone on the planet should have enough healthy food to eat, should have nutrition security, then we would have to do different things.
Yeah. Another stat in your book was 1 in 5 deaths are caused by poor diet.
Right.
That's a big stat, isn't it?
By some estimates, it's even more.
Really?
Yeah, I think that's what energizes me to talk about this stuff, because I think people don't realize how much influence they can have over their own health. I'm certainly not saying it's easy, but you can make different choices for yourself and have different outcomes.
Okay, so I think one of the biggest issues, and you touched on it a couple of minutes ago, is marketing. The people who market food are brilliant, aren't they? They really are brilliant. Every time you look at an advert, I mean, look, I'm a massive fan of America, by the way. I choose to go there a lot on my holidays. The way they market their food there, they often at a lower end of the scale, people are how much food you can get for how little money is often. I remember going to a pizza place and saying, can I have a slice of pizza? And they said, we don't sell slices. And I said, okay, what can I do? And they said, you can buy a pizza and take a slice out of it. And then they went, do you want the 2-for-1 deal or something? And I was like, I only want one slice of pizza.
Everything is supersized.
Now you're trying to push me 2 pizzas and a drink on the side. And it's a vat of pop, you know, like
fizzy. Oh, of course, the 64-ounce. Yeah.
I mean, and I was like, Christ. And I remember the last time I was there, I went into Starbucks and I was the only person who ordered a coffee. Everybody else in Starbucks is ordering a frappuccino, caramel, blah, 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 blah. And I'm the only one who said, can I have a coffee, please? People are drinking these really calorific drinks, aren't they? Mm-hmm. And nobody is saying, true. Oh, Starbucks, stop this shit. That this is bad for people buying this. It's tasty. But what I'm fascinated about, I've got 3 daughters and I've watched my 2 eldest now are 19. My youngest is 8, and she said to me the other day, can we have the new pink drink from Starbucks? So I said, not a chance. I don't know what it is. But already she, who never goes into Starbucks, knows there's a new pink drink at Starbucks. Mm-hmm. But I remember my eldest daughter, sorry, this is a monologue here, but I get to a point here where they wanted Bubbleology, and it's this new drink that had come into Britain. It was in the shopping malls. And they said, can we have one? And it was a liquid with bubbles of sugar in it of some description of another tasting sugary thing. And I looked to the queue and I went, if you really want it, you can, but I'm not queuing up there. Why are you going to queue up for a drink? This is insane. So I went off shopping and they queued up. But when I looked to the queue, it was just full. I hope people don't think I'm sexist here, but it was full of young women. And I thought, they've been marketed to on social media, young women, a stupid sugary drink which has come from Japan with a big straw, and it's probably a British company or American company, no idea, Bubbleology it was called. And I thought, this is insane, you want to put all that sugar in you just for an Instagram photo and everything else. But that is where we're at with it, aren't we?
Right, it is true. I try to avoid seeing a lot of food advertisements, to be honest. I don't really want that in my brain, but I see it. I have a 7-year-old niece who is very highly influenced by ads when it comes to food, and I know it's a big problem. So yeah, I wish we could take a page out of your book and ban that type of advertising, at least for children. But then of course there's social media, which is a whole different world. And there's not as much kale. There's not as much influencers peddling kale or lentils as there are, you know, unicorn cake, rainbow sprinkles, neon colored drink. That's definitely, where the eyeballs go on Instagram and the money follows.
Yeah, but it's not even just if you're watching TV or social media. If you decide to step out of the house and you decide to go to a theme park or Disney in America, you are peddled sugar from the minute you enter those places. It's like, and I saw these people, I'm sorry if you're listening to this, but I think it's insane if you do this and you're listening to this, but I saw these people and they were wearing cups with straps on them. And I said to my friend, what's that cup with it? Why are they wearing a cup with a strap? It's like, because you get free refills. You pay a certain amount of money at the beginning, and then all day long you can drink sugary pop. And I'm thinking, oh my God, what are people not watching? Where's the message not coming across that you cannot have that much sugar going into your diet and be healthy? Sugar is not good for you in mass quantities,
of
is
course.
It?
Of course not. As we both know, and I think this is true in England as it is in the United States, nutrition is not taught to kids in schools. And even doctors receive something like fewer than 14 hours of nutrition training. I personally switched to a plant-based diet a few years ago when my cholesterol was getting high and my doctor wanted to put me on statin medications. And I said to her that I'd like to try diet. And she said, your diet is already pretty good, which it was. But I knew the research on plant-based diets. I knew that I was likely to see a drop in my cholesterol numbers if I really committed to not only eliminating animal products, but also increasing the plant-based foods that are known to lower cholesterol, like whole grains and beans. And I knew more than my doctor did, which is, my doctor is a really smart lady. I actually have a new doctor now, but you know, sometimes you have to educate your doctor. And sure enough, within 6 months, my numbers were normal again.
Yeah, I suppose in fairness to British schools over here, we do try and educate our children on on diet often, and we're, you know, they come home and they do projects on it and everything else. However,
that's great.
Oh, they do, honestly, over here. They do it a lot. And we do healthy eating weeks and stuff like that. But the lure, and I mean, my daughters get so angry with me because I refuse to buy them a vat of popcorn when I go to the cinema. But the lure of that stuff when we enter a place, I think is really bad. But I'm scared to actually say that because everyone just goes, oh, Lovejoy, you're a killjoy. And it's like, I can't actually face that much sugar going into my children's faces. I just think it looks weird. And but yeah, only because you order a small popcorn over here and it's like a 2 or 3 pints of popcorn. It's
same
insane
thing here.
And yeah. I know it's the same in America, and it's like no one can eat that much food. It's mental. And so but what I don't get is why over here we've got Boris Johnson, over there you've got Biden, why they aren't going, hold on to the cinema multiplexes and Disney and stuff. This is vulgar. Stop doing it. You know, if they want
to
have a Coke, they can have a cup of Coke if they want a Coke. That's it. Why are you selling them a vat of refillable Coke? This is vulgar. Here's the health. Why can't you, you know, and then maybe the attitudes of the public would change.
I think the attitudes are changing, but slowly. We all have our limited lifetimes here. And some of these changes are sadly intergenerational. I hate to say it. I really am hopeful for the next generation, your daughters and my niece, that we see more people becoming food advocates in their community, demanding the kind of changes that we're talking about, and certainly making the choices in their own lives to support their health. That's my hope.
Yeah. I do, by the way, eat a variety, so everyone knows, of all foods. I'm not like you, plant-based. I do eat everything, but I do try and keep it as healthy as possible. And
I definitely believe there's more than one way to a healthy diet. I have no judgment against anybody who's thinking about their diet is definitely doing more than most people who are not thinking at all.
Yeah, I do, but I get in trouble because I tell everybody not worry about what's going on in their mouth, worry about what's going on in their gut. And I said the other day, actually, on social media, and I got a lot of pushback from it when I said someone asked me what I was having for dinner and blah, 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 and what if I have a pudding with every meal. And I laughed. I'm like, I can't remember having a pudding at home. It's just not something I would contemplate doing. But I said only eat 3 meals a week that like tingle your taste buds. The rest of the time, make sure you're eating for nutrition and calories. And I have lived my life pretty much like that. But people can't stand the idea that every meal is not a form of a pleasure in the mouth. I just, it doesn't matter, because once it's in the gut, the pleasure's gone. Very short-lived thing.
Well,
but I know I'm unique in that. It's just,
I'll take a slightly different position, and I think that you can have both things. In addition to my work as a health writer, I'm also a recipe developer, and I insist that everything I eat be delicious. Plants are extremely delicious. Whole grains, legumes, nuts, seeds, spices. There's a huge range of flavors in the, you know, the environmentally friendly plant-based playbook. You don't have to give up enjoyment of meals.
I agree, but I also think you need to suffer constantly during the week to make yourself feel alive. So,
you need to do what during the week?
Suffer. You got to
suffer.
You
no. Cut.
Yeah,
no,
you
no.
do. You got to cut. Joy, you got a cold shower every morning because it hurts and it's horrible.
No way.
And then it makes you feel alive. And then you got to do some exercise and push yourself and feel terrible. Makes you feel alive. And that.
I do it. I cannot get into the cold shower. That's too much for me. But I love exercising, but I do exercise that makes me feel good. I'm a healthy hedonist. You know, I want to feel my best. And that's another thing. Like, the pleasure from a healthy meal is not just culinary. How you feel going forward is really worth it, I think.
That could not be more true. If you do have a poor diet out there and you start changing it to something that's good, you just feel great about yourself all the time. I mean, it really is. It's such a cliche, and you mentioned it, but what you put in you is what you are. And so you really should be putting good ingredients in you. And
it's
not
very
just
powerful.
Exactly, you know, and stop, you know, just having masses of calories of weird food or crap food just because it's tingling your taste buds. And I think it's a really good lesson for people to look into actually why it's tingling your taste buds. At the moment over here, we're all obsessed with chili sauce. And I get it, because chili sauce just gives you a buzz in your
chili
tongue.
Chili sauce, like hot sauce?
Yeah, hot sauce. Yeah, hot sauce on everything has hot sauce on it over here at the moment. And prior to that, years ago, we had mayonnaise. And I think a lot of people still do mayonnaise, but you have to understand, in mayonnaise, there's a lot of vinegar and there's a lot of salt, and they tingle your taste buds. Mm-hmm. Tomato ketchup, we used to have a lot of. And again, that's tingling your taste buds. That's what all it is. And that's
why ketchup is more sugar than tomato.
Oh, and sugar. Yeah, sorry. There's sugar in there. Yeah. And there's also sugar and salt, isn't there? Yeah. Because I learned that early when I was on this, because I'm on a cooking show. If you want to make something nice, stick a load of salt, chili, sugar in it or whatever, and just try and get the combinations to try and clash with each other a bit. If you get a bit of sweet and a bit of sour going, that works well. And all these things, they just make food taste great. And I think that's what these companies have used. Obviously, they heavily salt their food, don't they?
They take it to a ridiculous extreme, though. When you buy a packaged food, it has much more salt and sugar than you would ever use at home, and fat.
Yeah.
They take it to an absurd degree. That's where we start talking about food that could be looked at as being addictive. And when you stop eating that kind of food, your taste buds change. So it is less appealing to you over time, and more wholesome food with less fat, sugar, and salt becomes normal.
Agreed. If you have a salad without a dressing on it, you can really taste all the ingredients, and it's absolutely delicious. You know, I love tasting all the ingredients, but I think we become so used to sticking a dressing or a mayonnaise or something on it, and that because that's what it does. It tickles the taste buds.
Well, I would never have a salad with no dressing on it, but if you enjoy it, that's great. And you don't have to. You don't have to give up your dressing to feel healthy. I made a wonderful dressing last night with just almonds, herbs, water, vinegar, and I think a little touch of maple syrup in the blender. It was a delicious oil-free dressing that actually brought the nutrition of almonds in addition to being tasty.
Joy, it sounds too healthy. You're not suffering enough. You have to suffer to enjoy your life.
I oppose that message. No.
You need to start cold showering, because once you get the hang of it, it's very addictive, because every morning.
I have read that's very beneficial in a number of ways. I just can't do it.
Oh, it's terrible. Every morning you get in the shower and think, oh God, why can't I just have a hot shower? And then you have the cold one, and then you get out and you feel $1 million. Right. And another thing that you say in your book, which is interesting. I wanted to do a documentary on this once, but local foods are being wiped out, aren't they? Healthy local foods in many countries. Again, mm-hmm. Maybe America's fault, but I wanted
food
to
traditions.
Do...
You mean like whole cuisines?
Yes, yeah. Like traditional cuisines and stuff, because the chip has become, and the pizza and the burger and the fried chicken have become so popular that it's actually, you know, and it's so tasty that it's sort of mm-hmm. slowly diminishing local cuisines. That's true.
You know, there's research that shows that looked at Japanese people who had moved to Hawaii and moved away from their traditional diet suffered obesity just like Americans, whereas those who maintained their traditional diet stayed at a healthy weight, you know. And it is a shame that these healthful traditional diets are being, you know, that they're being minimized. I would never say that Japanese cuisine is in danger. People revere Japanese cuisine all over the world, but it is true that when people move away from their roots, so to speak, they sometimes leave those beneficial food traditions behind as well.
Yeah, they surely do. And one of the other things that I think has changed a lot, and the pandemic has pushed it really, has made it even bigger, is the delivery. So we have Deliveroo, Uber Eats, just eating that. And when you go onto their sites, I must say I'm a fan of Nando's. I like a chicken, but I've, you know, during the pandemic, we were sort of, these apps were here and everybody just seemed to be ordering in constantly because of that. But I have a lot of young people come on my show, and they only know to eat through Deliveroo. And it's so bizarre. That's like every meal is, what shall I order from Deliveroo? That's a pretty new thing, isn't it, that's happening? And I suppose with Deliveroo as well, it's not always going to be the healthiest option, is it?
It was really accelerated by the pandemic, especially as people didn't feel comfortable going to restaurants, and food prepared away from home is typically much less healthful than food that you make yourself at home. A little bit of a funny story. I am a writer. I do lots of projects. I do journalism, but I also sometimes write content for brands. And a brand, one of these delivery apps, reached out. They were looking for a writer to basically just like chronicle their experience using the delivery app. And so I said, I've never actually used this delivery app or any delivery app. I've never had any food delivered to my house, but let me check out the platform. Maybe there's some kind of healthy food there. Then maybe there's somebody that has compostable containers that I could get behind and write about for you. So I did a little research. I looked into it. I got back to the company. I was like, okay, I could write this up for you in this way. And they simply were like, no, thank you. It's like, they do not want my perspective out there, which is that delivery is typically at odds with your health goals.
Yeah. Well, it is, because when you go on it, I mean, look, I'll be really honest with you. I go on the app sometimes, you know, I don't often do it, but I prefer just, cooking food and suffering, but I'm joking, by the way.
How are we going to get you into cooking food and not suffering?
Suffering makes you feel alive, Joy. when I'm looking at the Deliveroo app, I mean, I mean pizza and fried chicken and burgers and Wagamamas and all that, and you're like looking at it going, oh my god, all this food looks great. So I think getting to the point of what we need to do, though, right, individually you're saying you need to do your research, you need to eat food which fits your values, I suppose that's what you said, isn't it?
Yes, your health values as well as your environmental values, I think, are the most important ones, and your cultural values as well. Maybe you do come from a culture with a more traditional food way, and that's important to you to maintain it and keep it alive.
Okay, but the biggest thing from your book is how this is being allowed to happen. You know, it started a while ago in the 40s or whatever, and it's still prevalent now, right? And it's not going away. What are we going to do as the world, or America and Britain? What are we going to do about it?
I think simultaneously you need to become a food activist and start in your community. Maybe where you live, your city or town has a school lunch program that is feeding processed food to the kids in your community every day. And that's something that you can work on. Maybe you can work on a campaign that wants to try to get subsidies to people that are going to grow fruits, farmers that will grow fruits and vegetables. Or maybe you want to, in the United States, we have the SNAP program. It's like a supplemental program for people that have lower incomes to have access to food. Maybe you want to start a SNAP doubling program at farmers markets where you live. There's a lot of ways to get involved. And I think the best way is to start where you are. Does that make sense?
I think it does. Yeah. I think it's such a complex issue, though. I felt all the way through this conversation that I'm insulting people who will say things like, I don't have enough money to buy the sort of food that you think I should be eating. Though I do think fruit and vegetables is relatively cheap.
Yeah, it's hard to be cheaper than rice and beans.
Yeah, it's true. But I think there's a lot of anger to do with food. And I think a lot of people don't want to be told. It's like, you know, when you tell people to give up smoking, they don't want to.
Right.
I think that's it's a really tough ask to ask people to change it. And I do feel we've got to look at the authorities, the governments, to be saying, hold on, it makes me proud that you're happy that we're getting rid of marketing fast food to children. But I think we need to be thinking about this everywhere we go. And I think
it's on every level.
Yeah, there needs to be a bit of a pushback on giant sweets and, you know, huge bags of popcorn and things as well. I think people have got to start saying, really, do you really want to give this to people? You know,
we did talk a bit about these supersized sugary drinks, and in various places around the world they've imposed the so-called soda tax, which has good results in terms of reducing consumption. That's when people have to pay a tax on top of their whatever the regular tax is to get these sugar sweetened beverages. That is the type of stick, as in a carrot and stick, that seems to work well, but there's immense pushback against it typically.
Yeah. Again, people hate being told what they're allowed to eat, and also they hate being taxed on things, you know?
But it works. I mean, that works. We've seen it reduce consumption of sugary beverages.
Well, Joy, I'm conscious of your time. I know you have to get off and do other things today. So thank you so much for joining us. What are you working on next? Anything exciting?
What am I working on next? I just actually wrapped up a great project. I worked as a recipe developer on a forthcoming cookbook called Mastering the Art of Plant-Based Cooking. I believe that'll be out in 2022. I'm thinking of launching a nutrition newsletter. You know how writers these days are all launching newsletters, and I'm no different. If you want to stay up to date about that, you can follow me on Instagram at Joy Manning.
Okay. And just finally, on the plant-based diet, how hard is it for you to get everything you require, all the nutrition and minerals and everything else and calories you require on a daily basis? Is it hard work?
It's much easier than it was when I was eating an omnivore's diet, to
really?
Be honest. Yeah, absolutely. Vegetables, legumes, whole grains, these have vitamins and minerals and antioxidants and spades. My blood work shows that, you know, my calcium is fine, my iron is fine. The one thing that I did need a supplement for, which everyone does if they are going to follow a plant-based diet, is B12.
That's what Tim Spector said when he was on my podcast. That was the one thing when he decided to really reduce his meat, I think to pretty much nothing. He was lacking B12, so he took supplements, and then he wasn't getting the rates up, so he decided that once, I can't remember the period now, I'll have to go back and listen, but maybe once a month he'd eat red meat, and then he'd get his B12 back up again, and then it
and that worked for him.
Yeah, I think so. I think that was it. So he decided to do. Though I must listen back to the podcast to make sure that's exactly what he said, because I'm worried about quoting people. Anyway, Joy, thank you so much for joining us today. Your book is Our Food Killing Us? It's out now, and it's a thoroughly good read, even though a little overwhelming in places. Get yourself some cold showers, Joy, and
okay,
and see if you can handle it. Thank you so much for joining me.
Hey, if you need any recipes that are both delicious and healthy, you let me know. I'll send them your way.
Perfect.
And it was a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much, Tim.